Forgotten Classics, where a good story never goes out of style.
Hello, everyone. I'm Julie, and here we have episode 117 of Forgotten Classics, where we will continue with The Riddle of the Sands. And hark, I hear one of my co-hosts, as somebody put it, and luckily they were pleased. I have to do this after work a lot of the time, and so I hate to put our two boxers back in crates, but they are a little noisy. Although I think I do manage to keep them out of the actual story reading most of the time, so thank you for your patience. Before I get to the actual podcast highlight, I wanted to say I just listened to the season finale of We're Alive, and oh, come on, is somebody else listening to that who will talk to me about it? That was pretty good, huh? Wow, I can hardly wait till next fall. And I can't believe I have to wait till next fall. Oh, but if you're not listening to it, I highly encourage it. Yes, there are zombies, but it's not too bad most of the time. It's really a survival tale, end of the world kind of thing, and I love those kind of stories. However, let's get to the real podcast highlight for this time, which is not about zombies, although it is about eating, and we know zombies love to eat. Brains. These people don't. This podcast is called Sporkful, and it is definitely about eating. Let me just make this important distinction, which they also make. It's actually about food, but not about cooking or recipes or restaurants. They're talking about eating. They cover the kinds of things you might expect: grilled cheese, pasta, chicken parmigiana, milkshakes, coffee. But then you get into those areas that I suppose do fall under eating or food, but I don't think of them that way. Ice cubes? Mm-hmm. Yep. Whole show about it. Gum? Indeed. Even popcorn etiquette. That was part two of the popcorn series. So they have a lot of fun with it. The two hosts, Dan and Mark, are former co-workers at NPR, and they have a very good dynamic. They're very enjoyable to listen to. They riff off each other well in a pretty kind way. And along the way, since these shows are only 15 minutes long, they don't take that long, but along the way, you might learn something new. For example, I just enjoy listening to them. I really did not expect it to change my potato chip eating world. However, I sat up and took note because I was put on my mettle when one of them said, "The British are years ahead of us in chip technology," which I found hard to believe. The other fellow did not agree. But what happened was they were so enthusiastic about these smaller batch gourmet-style, homemade-style potato chips that I had always been looking at as a big ripoff and so expensive, and they may be a big ripoff, but and they're definitely so expensive. But I went and tried some, and that was both a good thing because they were completely delicious, and it was a very bad thing because they were so expensive. But it was a good thing because that means we won't be eating so many potato chips. But it's a bad thing because I can't quit eating them when the bag's open. So listening to this podcast, be careful. You might not just enjoy it. It might change the way you look at food. As I say, it's pretty short. They've done a whole lot of episodes. I particularly enjoyed the peanut butter and jelly series. Yes, it was a series. So, you know, dip in there. You'll find something you want to listen to them about. Give them a try. Now, let's get to The Riddle of the Sands. Carruthers has gotten established on the boat. He and Davis have kind of gotten to like each other. Although, Carruthers has realized how very bad he is at doing anything, and how very competent and what a decent fellow and a courageous chap Davis is. So, that seems like a promising beginning. A little humility. a little admiration of somebody you didn't used to admire before, but there's still that hint of mystery, that missing page from the ship's log. Now, Carruthers thought that was about embarrassment and getting himself into a little trouble, but is that all it is? Well, we're going to get a little bit more information about what happened on that missing log page today. Let's not wait any longer. Come on, dive in, and I'll meet you on the other side. The Riddle of the Sands, A Record of Secret Service, by Erskine Childers. This book is in the public domain. Chapter 6, Schley Fjord. I make no apology for having described these early days in some detail. It is no wonder that their trivialities are as vividly before me as the colors of earth and sea in this enchanting corner of the world. For every trifle, sordid or picturesque, was relevant, every scrap of talk a link, every passing mood critical for good or ill. So slight, indeed, were the determining causes that changed my autumn holiday into an undertaking the most momentous I have ever approached. 2 more days preceded the change. On the first, the southwesterly wind still holding, we sallied forth into Augustinenburg Fjord. To practice smartness in a heavy thresh, as Davis put it, it was the day of dedication for those disgusting oilskins, immured in whose stiff and odorous angles I felt distressfully cumbersome. A day of proof for me, indeed, for heavy squalls swept incessantly over the lock, and Davis, at my own request, gave me no rest. Backwards and forwards we tacked, blustering into coves and out again, reefing and unreefing, now stung with rain, now warmed with sun, but never with time to breathe or think. I wrestled with intractable ropes, slaves if they could be subdued, tyrants if they got the upper hand. Creeping, craning, straining, I made the painful round of the deck, while Davis, hatless and tranquil, directed my blundering movements. Now take the helm and try steering in a hard breeze to windward. It's the finest sport on earth. So I grappled with the niceties of that delicate craft, smarting eyes, chafed hands, and dazed brain all pressed into the service, while Davis, taming the ropes the while, shouted into my ear the subtle mysteries of the art. That fidgeting ripple in the luff of the mainsail, and the distant rattle from the heavy jib, signs that they are starved of wind and must be given more. The heavy list and wallow of the hull, the feel of the wind on your cheek instead of your nose, the broader angle of the burgee at the masthead, signs that they have too much, and that she is sagging recreantly to leeward instead of fighting to windward. He taught me the tactics for meeting squalls, and the way to press your advantage when they are defeated. The iron hand in the velvet glove that the willful tiller needs if you are to gain your ends with it. The exact set of the sheets necessary to get the easiest and swiftest play of the hull. All these things and many more I struggled to apprehend, careless for the moment as to whether they were worth knowing, but doggedly set on knowing them. Needless to say, I had no eyes for beauty. The wooded inlets we dived into gave a brief respite from wind and spindrift, but called into use the lead and centerboard tackle, 2 new and cumbrous complexities. Davis's passion for intricate navigation had to be sated even in these secure and tideless waters. "Let's get in as near as we can. You stand by the lead," was his formula. So I made false casts, tripped up in the slack, sent rivers of water up my sleeves, and committed all the other gaucheries that beginners in the art commit, while the sand showed whiter beneath the keel, till Davis regretfully drew off and shouted, "Ready about, centerplate down!" and I dashed down to the trappings of that diabolical contrivance, the only part of the Dulcibella's equipment that I hated fiercely to the last. It had an odious habit, when lowered, of spouting jets of water through its chain lead onto the cabin floor. One of my duties was to gag it with cotton waste, but even then its choking gurgle was a most uncomfortable sound in your dining room. In a minute, the creek would be behind us, and we would be thumping our stern into the short hollow waves of the fjord and lurching through spray and rain for some point on the opposite shore. Of our destination and objects, if we had any, I knew nothing. At the northern end of the fjord, just before we turned, Davis had turned dreamy in the most exasperating way, for I was steering at the time, and in mortal need of sympathetic guidance if I was to avoid a sudden jibe. As though continuing aloud some internal debate, he held a one-sided argument to the effect that it was no use going further north. Duck's weather and charts figured in it, but I did not follow the pros and cons. I only know that we suddenly turned and began to battle south again. At sunset we were back once more in the same quiet pool among the trees and fields of All Sound, a wonderful peace succeeding the turmoil. Bruised and sodden, I was extricating myself from my oily prison, and later was tasting, though not nearly yet in its perfection, the unique exultation that follows such a day, when, glowing all over, deliciously tired and pleasantly sore, you eat what seems to be ambrosia, be it only tinned beef, and drink nectar, be it only distilled from terrestrial hops or coffee beans, and inhale as culminating luxury balmy fumes which even the happy Homeric gods knew not of. On the following morning, the 30th, a joyous shout of "Nor'west wind!" sent me shivering on deck in the small hours to handle rain-stiff canvas and cutting chain. It was a cloudy, unsettled day, but still enough after yesterday's boisterous ordeal. We retraced our way past Sonderburg, and thence sailed for a faint line of pale green on the far southwestern horizon. It was during this passage that an incident occurred, which, slight as it was, opened my eyes to much. A flight of wild duck crossed our bows at some little distance, a wedge-shaped phalanx of craning necks and flapping wings. I happened to be steering while Davis verified our course below, but I called him up at once, and a discussion began about our chances of sport. Davis was gloomy over them. "Those fellows at Satrup were rather doubtful," he said. "There are plenty of ducks, but I made out that it's not easy for strangers to get shooting. The whole country's so very civilized, it's not wild enough, is it?" He looked at me. I had no very clear opinion. It was anything but wild in one sense, but there seemed to be wild enough spots for ducks. The shore we were passing appeared to be bordered by lonely marshes, though a spacious champaign showed behind. If it were not for the beautiful places we had seen, and my growing taste for our way of seeing them, his disappointing vagueness would have nettled me more than it did. For, after all, he had brought me out loaded with sporting equipment under a promise of shooting. "Bad weather is what we want for ducks," he said. "But I'm afraid we're in the wrong place for them. Now, if it was the North Sea, among those Frisian islands—" His tone was timid and interrogative, and I felt at once that he was sounding me as to some unpalatable plan whose nature began to dawn on me. He stammered through a sentence or two about "wildness" and "nobody to interfere with you." And then I broke in, "You surely don't want to leave the Baltic." "Why not?" he said, staring into the compass. "Hang it, man," I returned tartly. "Here we are in October, the summer over and the weather gone to pieces. We're alone in a cockleshell boat at a time when every other yacht of our size is laying up for the winter. Luckily, we seem to have struck an ideal cruising ground, with a wide choice of safe fjords and a good prospect of ducks, if we choose to take a little trouble about them. You can't mean to waste time and run risks. I thought of the torn leaf in the logbook. In a long voyage to those forbidding haunts of yours in the North Sea.
It's not very long, said Davis doggedly. Part of it's canal, and the rest is quite safe if you're careful. There's plenty of sheltered water, and it's not really necessary.
What's it all for? I interrupted impatiently. We haven't tried for shooting here yet. You've no notion, have you, of getting the boat back to England this autumn?
England, he muttered. Oh, I don't much care.
Again his vagueness jarred on me. There seemed to be some bar between us, invisible and insurmountable. And after all, what was I doing here? Roughing it in a shabby little yacht, utterly out of my element, with a man who a week ago was nothing to me, and who now was a tiresome enigma. Like swift poison, the old morbid mood in which I left London spread through me. All I had learnt and seen slipped away. What I had suffered remained. I was on the point of saying something which might have put a precipitate end to our cruise, but he anticipated me.
"I'm awfully sorry," he broke out, "for being such a selfish brute. I don't know what I was thinking about. You're a brick to join me in this sort of life, and I'm afraid I'm an infernally bad host. Of course, this is just the place to cruise. I forgot about the scenery and all that. Let's ask about the ducks here. As you say, we're sure to get sport if we worry and push a bit. We must be nearly there now. Yes, there's the entrance. Take the helm, will you?"
He sprang up the mast like a monkey and gazed over the land from the crosstrees. I looked up at my enigma and thanked Providence that I had not spoken, for no one could have resisted his frank outburst of good nature. Yet it occurred to me that, considering the conditions of our life, our intimacy was strangely slow in growth. I had no clue yet as to where his idiosyncrasies began and his self ended, and he, I surmised, was in the same stage toward me. Otherwise I should have pressed him further now, for I felt convinced that there was some mystery in his behavior which I had not yet accounted for. However, light was soon to break. I could see no sign of the entrance he had spoken of, and no wonder, for it is only 80 yards wide, though it leads to a fjord 30 miles long. All at once we were jolting in a tumble of sea, and the channel grudgingly disclosed itself, stealing between marshes and meadows, and then broadening to a mere, as at Ekken. We anchored close to the mouth, and not far from a group of vessels of a type that afterwards grew very familiar to me. They were sail barges, something like those that ply in the Thames, bluff-bowed, high-sterned craft of about 50 tons, ketch-rigged, and fitted with leeboards, very light spars, and a long tip-tilted bowsprit. For the future, I shall call them galliots. Otherwise, the only sign of life was a solitary white house, the pilot's house, the chart told us, close to the northern point of entrance. After tea, we called on the pilot, patriarchally installed before a roaring stove in the company of a buxom, bustling daughter-in-law and some rosy grandchildren. We found a rotund and rubicund person who greeted us with a hoarse roar of welcome in German, which instantly changed when he saw us, to the funniest broken English, spoken with intense relish and pride. We explained ourselves and our mission as well as we could through the hospitable interruptions caused by beer and the strains of a huge musical box which had been set going in honor of our arrival. Needless to say,
I was read like a book at once and fell into the part of listener.
"Yes, yes," he said. "All right. There is plenty ducks. But first we will drink a glass beer. Then we will shift your ship, Captain. She lies not good there."
Davis started up in a panic, but was waved back to his beer.
"Then we will drink another glass beer. Then we will talk of ducks. No, then we will kill ducks. That is better. Then we will have plenty glasses beer."
This was an unexpected climax, and promised well for our prospects, and the program was fully carried out. After the beer, our host was packed briskly by his daughter into an armor of woolen gaiters, coats, and mufflers, topped with a worsted helmet, which left nothing of his face visible but a pair of twinkling eyes. Thus equipped, he led the way out of doors and roared for Hans and his gun, till a great gawky youth with high cheekbones and a downy beard came out from the yard and sheepishly shook our hands. Together we repaired to the quay, where the pilot stood looking like a genial ball of worsted, and bawled hoarse directions while we shifted the Dulcibella to a berth on the farther shore close to the other vessels. We returned with our guns, and the interval for refreshments followed. It was just dusk when we sallied out again, crossed a stretch of bogland, and took up strategic posts round a stagnant pond. Hans had been sent to drive, and the result was a fine mallard and three ducks. It was true that all fell to the pilot's gun, perhaps owing to Hans's filial instinct, and his parents' canny egotism in choosing his own lair. Or perhaps it was chance. But the shooting party was nonetheless a triumphal success. It was celebrated with beer and music as before, while the pilot, an infant on each podgy knee, discoursed exuberantly on the glories of his country and the Elysian content of his life.
"There is plenty beer, plenty meat, plenty money, plenty ducks," summed up his survey.
It may have been fancy, but Davis, though he had fits and starts of vivacity, seemed very inattentive, considering that we were sitting at the feet of so expansive an oracle. It was I who elicited most of the practical information, details of time, weather, and likely places for shooting, with some shrewd hints as to the kind of people to conciliate. Whatever he thought of me, I warmed with sympathy toward the pilot, for he assumed we had done with cruising for the year, and thought us mad enough as it was to have been afloat so long, and madder still to intend on living on
so little a ship,
when we could live on land with beer and music handy. I was tempted to raise the North Sea question, just to watch Davis under the thunder of rebukes which would follow, but I refrained from a wish to be tender with him, now that all was going so well. The Frisian Islands were an extravagant absurdity now. I did not even refer to them as we pulled back to the Dulcibella, after swearing eternal friendship with the good pilot and his family. Davis and I turned in good friends that night. Or rather, I should say that I turned in, for I left him sucking an empty pipe and aimlessly fingering a volume of Mahan, and once when I woke in the night, I felt somehow that his bunk was empty, and that he was there in the dark cabin, dreaming. Chapter 7. The Missing Page. I woke, on 1st October, with that dispiriting sensation that a hitch has occurred in a settled plan. It was explained when I went on deck, and I found the Dulcibella wrapped in a fog, silent, clammy, nothing visible from her decks but the ghostly hull of a galleot at anchor near us. She must have been brought up there in the night, for there had been nothing so close the evening before, and I remembered that my sleep had been broken once by sounds of rumbling chain and gruff voices.
"This looks pretty hopeless for today,"
I said with a shiver to Davis, who was laying the breakfast.
"Well, we can't do anything till this fog lifts," he answered with a good deal of resignation. Breakfast was a cheerless meal. The damp penetrated to the very cabin, whose roof and walls wept a fine dew. I had dreaded a bathe, and yet missed it, and the ghastly light made the tablecloth look dirtier than it naturally was, and all the accessories more sordid. Something had gone wrong with the bacon, and the lack of egg cups was not in the least humorous. Davis was just beginning in his summary way to tumble the things together for washing up, when there was a sound of a step on deck. Two sea boots appeared on the ladder, and before we could wonder who the visitor was, a little man in oilskins and a sou'wester was stooping toward us in the cabin door, smiling affectionately at Davis out of a round, grizzled beard.
"Well met, Captain," he said quietly in German. "Where are you bound to this time?"
"Bartels!" exclaimed Davis, jumping up. The two stooping figures, young and old, beamed at one another like a father and son. "Where have you come from? Have some coffee. How's the Johannes? Was that you that came in last night? I'm delighted to see you." I spare the reader his uncouth lingo. The little man was dragged in and seated on the opposite sofa to me.
"I took my apples to Cappen," he said sedately, "and now I sail to Kiel, and so to Hamburg, where my wife and children are. It is my last voyage of the year. You are no longer alone, Captain, I see."
He had taken off his dripping sou'wester, and was bowing ceremoniously toward me.
"Oh, I quite forgot!"
said Davis, who had been kneeling on one knee in the low doorway, absorbed in his visitor.
"This is meiner Freund, Herr Carruthers. Carruthers, this is my friend Schiffer Bartels of the galliot Johannes."
Was I never to be at an end of the puzzles which Davis presented to me? All the impulsive heartiness died out of his voice and manner as he uttered the last few words, and there he was nervously glancing from the visitor to me, like one who, against his will or from tactlessness, has introduced two persons he knows will disagree. There was a pause while he fumbled with the cups, poured some cold coffee out, and pondered over it as though it were a chemical experiment. Then he muttered something about boiling some more water and took refuge in the forecastle. I was ill at ease at this period with seafaring men, but this mild little person was easy ground for a beginner. Besides, when he took off his oilskin coat, he reminded me less of a sailor than of a homely draper of some country town with his clean turned-down collar and neatly fitting frieze jacket. We exchanged some polite platitudes about the fog and his voyage last night from Cappen, which appeared to be a town some 15 miles up the fjord. Davis joined in from the forecastle with an excess of warmth, which almost took the words out of my mouth. We exhausted the subject very soon, and then my vis-à-vis smiled paternally at me as he had done at Davis, and said confidentially,
"It is good that the captain is no more alone. He is a fine young man. Heaven, what a fine young man! I love him as my son, but he is too brave, too reckless. It is good for him to have a friend."
I nodded and laughed, though in reality I was very far from being amused.
"Where was it you met?" I asked.
"In an ugly place and in ugly weather," he answered gravely, but with a twinkle of fun in his eye.
"But has he not told you?"
he added with ponderous slyness.
"I came just in time. No, what am I saying? He is brave as a lion and as quick as a cat. I think he cannot drown, but still it was an ugly place and ugly—"
"What are you talking about, Bartels?"
interrupted Davis, emerging noisily with a boiling kettle. I answered the question.
"I was just asking your friend how it was you made his acquaintance."
"Oh, he helped me out of a bit of a mess in the North Sea, didn't you, Bartels? He said.
It was nothing, said Bartels. But the North Sea is no place for your little boat, Captain. So I have told you many times. How did you like Flensborg? A fine town, is it not?
Did you find Herr Kronk, the carpenter?
I see you have placed a little mizzenmast. The rudder was nothing much, but it was well that it held to the Eider. But she is good and strong, your little ship, and heaven, she had need be so.
He chuckled and shook his head at Davis, as at a wayward child. This is all the conversation that I need record. For my part, I merely waited for its end, determined on my course, which was to know the truth once and for all and make an end of these distracting mystifications. Davis plied his friend with coffee and kept up the talk gallantly, but as affectionate as he was, his manner plainly showed that he wanted to be alone with me. The gist of the little skipper's talk was a parental warning that, though we were well enough here in the Ostsee, it was time for little boats to be looking for winter quarters, that he himself was going by the Kiel Canal to Hamburg to spend a cozy winter as a decent citizen at his warm fireside, and that we should follow his example. He ended with an invitation to us to visit him on the Johannes, and with suave farewells disappeared into the fog. Davis saw him into his boat, returned without wasting a moment, and sat down on the sofa opposite me.
"What did he mean?" I asked.
"I'll tell you," said Davis. "I'll tell you the whole thing. As far as you're concerned, it's partly a confession. Last night I had made up my mind to say nothing, but when Bartels showed up, I knew it must all come out. It's been fearfully on my mind, and perhaps you'll be able to help me. But it's for you to decide."
"Fire away," I said.
"You know what I was saying about the Frisian Islands the other day? A thing happened there which I never told you, when you were asking about my cruise."
"It began near Norderney," I put in.
"How did you guess that?" he asked.
"You're a bad hand at duplicity," I replied. "Go on."
"Well, you're quite right. It was there on 9th September. I told you the sort of thing I was doing at that time, but I don't think I said that I made inquiries from one or two people about duck shooting, and had been told by some fishermen at Borkum that there was a big sailing yacht in those waters, whose owner, a German of the name of Dolman, had shot a good deal and might give me some tips. Well, I found this yacht one evening, knowing it must be her from the description I had. She was what is called a barge yacht, of 50 or 60 tons, built for shallow water on the lines of a Dutch galliot, with lee boards and those queer round bows and a square stern. She's something like those galliots anchored near us now. You sometimes see the same sort of yacht in English waters, only there they copy the Thames barges. She looked a clipper of her own sort, and very smart, varnished all over and shining like gold. I came on her about sunset, after a long day of exploring round the Ems estuary. She was lying in—"
"Wait a bit, let's have the chart," I interrupted.
Davis found it, and spread it on the table between us, first pushing back the cloth and the breakfast things to one end, where they lay in a slovenly litter. This was one of the only two occasions on which I ever saw him postpone the rite of washing up, and it spoke volumes for the urgency of the matter in hand. "Here it is," said Davis.
"See map A."
And I looked with a new and strange interest at the long string of slender islands, the parallel line of coast, and the confusion of shoals, banks, and channels which lay between. "Here's Norderney, you see. By the way, there's a harbor there at the west end of the island, the only real harbor on the whole line of islands, Dutch or German, except at Terschelling. There's quite a big town there, too, a watering place where Germans go for sea bathing in the summer. Well, the Medusa, that was her name,
was lying in the Riff Gat roadstead, flying the German ensign, and I anchored for the night pretty near her. I meant to visit her owner later on, but I very nearly changed my mind, as I always feel rather a fool on smart yachts, and my German isn't very good. However, I thought I might as well, so after dinner, when it was dark, I sculled over in the dinghy, hailed a sailor on deck, said who I was, and asked if I could see the owner. The sailor was a surly sort of chap, and there was a good long delay while I waited on deck, feeling more and more uncomfortable. Presently a steward came up and showed me down the companion and into the saloon, which after this looked, well, horribly gorgeous. You know what I mean, plush lounges, silk cushions, and that sort of thing. Dinner seemed to be just over, and wine and fruit were on the table. Herr Dolman was there at his coffee. I introduced myself somehow.
"Stop a moment," I said. "What was he like?"
"Oh, a tall, thin chap in evening dress. About 50, I suppose, with grayish hair and a short beard. I'm not good at describing people. He had a high, bulging forehead, and there was something about him. But I think I'd better tell you the bare facts first. I can't say he seemed pleased to see me, and he couldn't speak English, and, in fact, I felt infernally awkward. Still, I had an object in coming, and as I was there, I thought I might as well gain it." The notion of Davis in his Norfolk jacket and rusty flannels haranguing a frigid German in evening dress in a gorgeous saloon tickled my fancy greatly. He seemed very much astonished to see me, had evidently seen the Dulcibella arrive and had wondered what she was. I began as soon as I could about the ducks, but he shut me up at once, said I could do nothing hereabouts. I put it down to a sportsman's jealousy. You know what that is. But I saw I had come to the wrong shop, and was just going to back out and end this unpleasant interview, when he thawed a bit, offered me some wine, and began talking in quite a friendly way, taking a great interest in my cruise and plans for the future. In the end we sat up quite late, though I never really felt at my ease. He seemed to be taking stock of me all the time, as though I were some new animal. How I sympathized with that German! We parted civilly enough, and I rode back and turned in, meaning to potter eastwards early next day. But I was knocked up at dawn by a sailor with a message from Dolman, asking if he could come to breakfast with me. I was rather flabbergasted, but didn't like to be rude, so I said yes. Well, he came, and I returned the call, and, well, the end of it was I stayed at anchor there for 3 days. This was rather abrupt.
"How did you spend the time?"
I asked. Stopping 3 days anywhere was an unusual event for him, as I knew from his log. "Oh, I lunched or dined with him once or twice. With them, I ought to say," he added hurriedly. "She didn't appear the evening I first called."
"And what was she like?"
I asked promptly, before he could hurry on. "Oh, she seemed a very nice girl," was the guarded reply, delivered with particular unconcern. "And the end of it was that I and the Medusa sailed away in company. I must tell you how it came about, just in a few words for present. It was his suggestion. He said he had to sail to Hamburg, and proposed that I should go with him in the Dulcibella as far as the Elbe, and then, if I liked, I could take the ship canal at Brunsbüttel through to Kiel and the Baltic. I had no very fixed plans of my own, though I meant to go on exploring eastwards between the islands and the coast, and so reach the Elbe in a much slower way. He dissuaded me from this, sticking to it that I should have no chance of ducks, and urging other reasons. Anyway, we settled to sail in company direct to Cuxhaven in the Elbe. With a fair wind and an early start, it should be only 1 day's sail of about 60 miles. The plan only came to a head in the evening of the third day, 12th September. I told you, I think, that the weather had broken after a long spell of heat. That very day it had been blowing pretty hard from the west, and the glass was falling still. I said, Of course, that I couldn't go with him if the weather was too bad. But he prophesied a good day, said it was an early sail, and altogether put me on my mettle. You can guess how it was. Perhaps I had talked about single-handed cruising as though it were easier than it was, though I never meant it in a boasting way, for I hate that sort of thing. And besides, there is no danger if you are careful.
Oh, go on, I said.
Anyway, we went next morning at 6. It was a dirty-looking day, wind west-northwest, but his sails were going up and mine followed. I took 2 reefs in, and we sailed out into the open and steered east-northeast along the coast for the Outer Elbe lightship, about 50 knots off. Here it all is, you see. He showed me the course on the chart. The trip was nothing for his boat, of course, a safe, powerful old tub forging through the sea as steady as a house. I kept up with her easily at first. My hands were pretty full, for there was a hard wind on my quarter and a troublesome sea, but as long as nothing worse came, I knew I should be all right, though I also knew I was a fool to have come. All went well until we were off Vangarook, the last of the islands, here, and then it began to blow really hard. I had half a mind to chuck it and cut into the Jade River, down there, but I hadn't the face to, so I hove to and took in my last reef. Simple words, simply uttered, but I had seen the operation in calm water and shuddered at the present picture. We had been about level till then, but with my shortened canvas I fell behind. Not that that mattered in the least. I knew my course, had read up on my tides, and thick as the weather was, I had no doubt of being able to pick up the lightship. No change of plan was possible now. The Weser estuary was on my starboard hand, but the whole place was a lee shore and a mass of unknown banks. Just look at them. I ran on, the Dulcibella doing her level best, but we had some narrow shaves of being pooped. I was about here, say 6 miles southwest of the lightship, see chart A, when I suddenly saw that the Medusa had hove to right ahead as though waiting till I came up. She wore round again on the course as I drew level, and we were alongside for a bit. Dolman lashed the wheel, leaned over her quarter, and shouted very slowly and distinctly so I could understand. "Follow me. See too bad for you outside. Short cut through sands. Save 6 miles." It was taking all my time to manage the tiller, but I knew what he meant at once, for I had been over the chart carefully the night before. See map A. You see, the whole bay between Vangarook and the Elbe is encumbered with sand. A great jagged chunk of it runs out from Cuxhaven in a northwesterly direction for 15 miles or so, ending in a pointed spit called the Scharhorn. To reach the Elbe from the west, you have to go right outside this, round the lightship, which is off the Scharhorn, and double back. Of course, that's what all big vessels do. But as you see, these sands are intersected here and there by channels very shallow and winding, exactly like those behind the Frisian Islands. Now look at this one, which cuts right through the big chunk of sand and comes out near Cuxhaven. The Telte, it's called. See chart A. It's miles wide, you see, at the entrance. But later on it's split in two by the Hohenhorn bank. Then it gets shallow and very complicated and ends in a mere tidal driblet with another name. It's just the sort of channel I should like to worry into on a fine day or with an offshore wind. Alone, in thick weather and a heavy sea, it would have been folly to attempt it except as a desperate resource. But as I said, I knew at once that Dolman was proposing to run for it and guide me in. I didn't like the idea because I like doing things for myself, and, silly as it sounds, I believe I resented being told the sea was too bad for me, which it certainly was. Yet the shortcut did save 7 miles, and the devil of a tumble off the Scharhorn, where 2 tides meet. I had complete faith in Dolman, and I suppose I decided I should be a fool not to take a good chance. I hesitated, I know, but in the end I nodded and held up my arm as she forged ahead again. Soon after, she shifted her course, and I followed. You asked me once if I ever took a pilot. That was the only time.
He spoke with bitter gravity, flung himself back, and felt his pocket for his pipe. It was not meant for a dramatic pause, but it certainly was one. I had just a glimpse of still another Davis, a Davis 5 years older, throbbing with deep emotions, scorn, passion, and stubborn purpose, a being above my plane, of sterner stuff, wider scope. Intense as my interest had become, I waited almost timidly while he mechanically rammed tobacco into his pipe and struck ineffectual matches. I felt that whatever the riddle to be solved, it was no mean one. He repressed himself with an effort, half rose and made his circular glance at the clock, barometer, and skylight, and then resumed. We soon came to what I knew must be the beginning of the Telte Channel. All around you could hear breakers on the sands, though it was too thick to see them yet. As the water shoaled, the sea, of course, got shorter and steeper. There was more wind, a whole gale, I should say. I kept dead in the wake of the Medusa, but to my disgust I found she was gaining on me very fast. Of course I had taken for granted, when he said he would lead me in, that he would slow down and keep close to me. He could easily have done so by getting his men up to check his sheets or drop his peak. Instead of that, he was busting on for all he was worth. Once, in a rain squall, I lost sight of him altogether, got him faintly again, but had enough to do with my own tiller not to want to be peering through the scud after a runaway pilot. I was all right so far, but we were fast approaching the worst part of the whole passage, where the Hohenhorn bank blocks the road and the channel divides. I don't know what it looks like to you on the chart. Perhaps fairly simple, because you can follow the twist of the channels as on a ground plan. But a stranger, coming to a place like that, where there are no buoys, mind you, can tell nothing certain by the eye, unless perhaps at dead low water when the banks are high and dry and in very clear weather. He must trust to the lead and the compass, and feel his way step by step. I knew perfectly well that what I should soon see would be a wall of surf stretching right across and on both sides. To feel one's way in that sort of weather is impossible. You must know your own way or else have a pilot. I had one, but he was playing his own game. With a second hand on board to steer while I conned, I should have felt less of an ass. As it was, I knew I ought to be facing the music in the offing, and cursed myself for having broken my rule and gone blundering into this confounded shortcut. It was giving myself away, doing just the very thing you can't do in single-handed sailing. By the time I realized the danger, it was too far to turn and hammer out into the open. I was deep in the bottleneck bight of the sands, jammed on a lee shore, and a strong flood tide sweeping me on. That tide, by the way, gave just the ghost of a chance. I had the hours in my head, and knew it was about two-thirds flood with 2 hours more of rising water. That meant the banks would be all covering when I reached them, and harder than ever to locate. But it also meant I might float right over the worst of them, if I hit off a lucky place. Davis thumped the table in disgust. Pah! It makes me sick to think of having to trust to an accident like that, like a lubberly cockney out for a boozy bank holiday sail. Well, just as I foresaw, the wall of surf appeared clean across the horizon and curling back to shut me in, booming like thunder. When I last saw the Medusa, she seemed to be charging at it like a horse at a fence, and I took a rough bearing of her position by a hurried glance at the compass. At that very moment I thought she seemed to luff and show some of her broadside, but a squall blotted her out and gave me hell with the tiller. After that she was lost in the white mist that hung over the line of breakers. I kept on my bearing as well as I could, but I was already out of the channel. I knew that by the look of the water, and as we neared the bank I saw it was all awash and without the vestige of an opening. I wasn't going to chuck her onto it without an effort. So more by instinct than with any particular hope, I put the helm down, meaning to work her along the edge on the chance of spotting a way over. She was buried at once by the beam sea, and the jib blew to blazes. But the reefed staysail stood, she recovered gamely, and I held on, though I knew it could only be for a few minutes, as the center plate was up, and she made frightful leeway toward the bank. I was half blinded by the scud, but suddenly I noticed what looked like a gap behind a spit which curled out right ahead. I luffed still more to clear this spit, but she couldn't weather it. Before you could say knife, she was driving across it, bumped heavily, bucked forward again, bumped again, and ripped on in deeper water. I can't describe the next few minutes. I was in some sort of channel, but a very narrow one, and the sea broke everywhere. I hadn't a proper command either, for the rudder had crocked up somehow at the last bump. I was like a drunken man running for his life down a dark alley, barking himself at every corner. It couldn't last long, and finally we went crash onto something and stopped there, grinding and banging. So ended that little trip under a pilot. Well, it was like this. There was really no danger. I opened my eyes at the characteristic phrase. I mean, that lucky stumble into a channel was my salvation. Since then, I had struggled through a mile of sands, all of which lay behind me like a breakwater against the gale. They were covered, of course, and seething like soap suds, but the force of the sea was deadened. The Dulce was bumping along, but not too heavily. It was nearing high tide, and at half ebb she would be high and dry. In the ordinary way, I should have run out a kedge with the dinghy, and at the next high water sailed farther in and anchored where I could lie afloat. The trouble was now that my hand was hurt, and my dinghy stove in, not to mention the rudder business. It was the first bump on the outer edge that did the damage. There was a heavy swell there, and when we struck, the dinghy, which was towing astern, came home on her painter and down with a crash on the yacht's weather quarter. I stuck out one hand to ward it off and got it nipped on the gunwale. She was badly stove in and useless, so I couldn't run out the kedge. This was Greek to me, but I let him go on. And for the present, my hand was too painful even to stow the boom and sails, which were whipping and racketing about anyhow. There was the rudder, too, to be mended, and we were several miles from nearest land. Of course, if the wind fell, it was all easy enough. But if it held or increased, it was a poor lookout. There's a limit to strain of that sort, and other things might have happened. In fact, it was precious lucky that Bartels showed up. His galliot was at anchor a mile away, up a branch of the channel. In a clear between squalls he saw us, and like a brick rowed his boat out. He and his boy and a devil of a pull they must have had. I was glad enough to see them. No, that's not true. I was in such a fury of disgust and shame that I believe I should have been idiot enough to say I didn't want help, if he hadn't just nipped on board and started work. He's a terror to work, that little mouse of a chap. In half an hour he had stowed the sails, unshackled the big anchor, run out 50 fathoms of warp, and hauled her off there and then into deep water. Then they towed her up the channel. It was dead to leeward and an easy job, and berthed her near their own vessel. It was dark by that time, so I gave them a drink and said good night. It blew a howling gale that night, but the place was safe enough with good ground tackle. The whole affair was over, and after supper I thought hard about it.
Okay, I apologize. That was probably a very frustrating place to stop.
Then I started thinking about what happened.
Nothing. But it's just how it worked out. So we are going to have plenty of time to think before the next episode. What is it that Davis put together? Now, the one thing that's obvious, despite the technical details, is that whoever was in this big boat, Professor Dolman, he was doing more than trying to ditch Davis, obviously. He deliberately led him into a hugely dangerous place where a newcomer would not know what's going on, and he had a tiny little boat,
And then he just floors it and abandons him. And there's no telling what would have happened, but we get a pretty good idea. Davis might not have made it out alive. So we have some things to think about there, and of course we'll find out more next time. I also really truly enjoyed the idea that this is supposed to be an espionage novel. We do know that up front. And Davis has got to be the world's worst at subterfuge. He can't take the log journal page out right. His ideas of, I don't think it's well enough here for ducks. Yeah, to ignore those ducks over there and all those marshy places we're going by. I'm pretty sure we've got to go back up north for it. Yeah, that's it. The guy is just too honorable and straightforward and all those great qualities that do not lend themselves to being sneaky and manipulating people. So it will be very interesting to see what it is that he tells Carruthers next time. Because Carruthers makes it very clear, if we remember way back to the beginning, where he's saying, well, gee, I'm sorry I'm dragging you through all these details. And I have to admit, sometimes you're just going, okay, got it. You learned how to sail by yourself, or better, moving on. But he makes the point, nothing here is wasted. There's a reason for every single thing he's telling us, even though we don't understand it. It's either going to be pertinent later, or it's something that's moving him toward, as he says, a momentous decision that changed his life. And that's all happening within these 2 days. I really admire the way the author is therefore saying, just put up with this, I'm setting it up. And also the way that, Davis has got this huge, long explanation he does. And he's not a very interesting person. And if you don't understand boating, which we can just assume that Erskine Childers would have known a great number of readers would not have, he's got to keep it simple enough that we can follow it, correct enough to satisfy himself, who loves yachting, and anybody who's reading it, and move us along toward the point of some more action happening. And so what he does is, every so often, Carruthers is thinking, oh man, you don't have to tell me you're an odd duck, or, hey, wait, let's look at the map, to remind the reader of there's more going on here. So I liked that technique, and plus it's all the stuff that we're thinking, whoa, I'm completely lost, stop, slow down, explain what's going on. That's pretty much all we can get out of that. But it is going to pick up with the very next chapter. Oh, did everybody else like the fact that, wow, Davis spent 3 days there? I wonder why. Then I met the young lady. Okay, never mind. Say no more. Describe her. We know why you stayed and why you went along and why you were kind of blinded to anything odd happening up to the point of, being stuck in a very dangerous situation. That's where we're left. As I say, we'll have more enlightenment next time. Don't think I really have much more to say. I am going to be participating this weekend in a read-along discussion at SFF Audio of The Status Civilization. Wow, it's really a great book, and I think I said that before, novella. But twists and turns when you don't expect it, and some very interesting philosophical concepts along the way, and that we are presented with at the end. I'm going to be very curious to see what everybody makes of it. Of course, I will put a link up to SFF Audio once that is up, and I think that'll probably be Monday. I think they usually come out on Mondays. That's pretty much it. If you'd like to make a comment or send me an email or take a look at all the past episodes, I know there are a few people who are actually working their way through all of them, and I salute you. The blog for the podcast is hcforgottenclassics.blogspot.com. If you want to leave an iTunes review, and you know I covet them, crave them, love them, like most podcasters, do go to iTunes, and if you type in Forgotten Classics into their iTunes store search box, it pops up first. Thank you very much for coming by and listening. It makes it tons of fun more for me. And otherwise, without people coming and listening and commenting, I would never have heard of this book.
So it's a two-way street, guys, and I really appreciate it. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.